Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Jawanza. So great to have you along. It's another beautiful day, and as always, I'm very, very excited to have an opportunity to speak with you again. I just want to take a moment and just thank everybody for all of your support. I want to thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing the links. I really, really appreciate it. I don't take you for granted. You obviously could be doing other things, but just by virtue of the fact that you leave me messages letting me know that you enjoy the show, and you know, I can tell by the numbers that you go back and listen to the shows, I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. I really, really appreciate you. And if you've been following for a while, you know that this is Professor Geiger's week, okay? Every month, Professor Geiger comes on to discuss his awesome book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success. So for all of you entrepreneurs out there, those have, if you're not an entrepreneur, considered becoming an entrepreneur, I've got a book that I want to recommend to you. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles. The author is my guest for tonight, Professor Joseph T. Geiger. You, I guarantee, are going to want to get this book. If you are a serious entrepreneur, then you know, just by being an entrepreneur, if you've been one for a while, you know that stuff always comes up. I mean, this is life. And so this book is a principles book, a book on business principles and also life principles. You can not only just apply it to your business, but you can apply these principles to life as well. So I can't wait to get into the interview again. We're going through the book principle by principle. We left off last week in chapter 4, but let me first introduce you to my guest. If you're just tuning in for the very first time, Professor Geiger is currently retired, and he grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. Now, over his lifetime, he has started 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management at J. Sargent Reynolds Community College, located in Richmond, Virginia. And we are very, very excited and honored and humbled to have as our resident business guru, Professor Joseph T. Geiger. Professor Geiger, welcome back to Health, Wealth, and Divine. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you very much. Such a introduction. My goodness, I hope I can begin to live up to that one.
Well, with your experience and having read your book several times, I can guarantee the listeners that he's definitely going to live up to the introduction. And actually, once you get the book and you read it, you'll see that the introduction was actually, I might not have done him justice. So I want to encourage everybody. We're going to tell you how you can get the book during the course of the interview, because you're going to want it. In addition, if you're an entrepreneur, you're going to need it, okay? So without further ado, let's jump into the interview. As we've been going through the book, last week we ended up on Chapter 4. That's where we left off, actually. There are actually two principles left in Chapter 4 before we move into Chapter 5, which is buying a business. We had two principles left in Chapter 4. But before we get into that, I would like, Professor, if you would, because I always like for the new listeners to know why they're listening to the person that they're listening to. You know, I like to bring on experts in their chosen field. And so, Professor, if you could give a little background on how you got started in business, what led to that, and some of the businesses that you've had along the way.
Well, I don't know, really. It was, I guess, a little bit by accident. I was always interested. When I was in high school, I had an opportunity to start a business. It's kind of interesting. I was sent to a private school because I had a very, very severe reading problem. I'm dyslexic, and they were trying to fix that. I had a great memory for the audio, but words on a page, I had a big problem with, and so I was sent away, and it kind of worked. It forced me to do a lot of reading, and although it was very, very slow, it still stuck. And when I was there, the school was kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and a lot of the, it was in New England, and a lot of the young people there, the students, were accustomed to reading the New York Times, and but it wasn't there. So I made a deal with, I found out who was the distributor in our area for the New York Times, and I talked them into giving me newspapers on the cuff, and so then I went out and sold subscriptions and ordered newspapers, and after I got them and got paid, well, then I paid them. Mm-hmm. And it I had that for 3 years, and when I left, I sold it. And I learned an awful lot about that. I learned, among other things, that you can't sell things to people who don't have any money. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the students had the money to buy a prescription or a subscription to the newspaper, but they didn't have the money to buy the business. So what I did is in the early spring, I found some who wanted to do it, but they didn't have the money. And then when Parents' Day was there, I made it a point to look up the parents and tell the parents how their son could learn something about business and make a lot of money for themselves, or what was a lot of money there. And I succeeded in selling the business. And when I was in college, I made little tiny trout flies, and I was in Denver, Colorado, and I sold those to a sporting goods store. And I sold them for, as it turns out, probably about 10 times as much as they could buy new ones, or the ones that were made by regular production manufacturers. But mine were very, very tiny. And so they ended up buying mine because the customers wanted them. And they ended up selling them for 17 times as much as the customers could buy larger ones. And I, as it turns out, the reason was, instead of selling them one at a time, I put three of them in a little jewelry case, a little clear plastic jewelry case, and sold them as kind of trinkets, not necessarily fishing lures. And that made a very big difference in my income. I went from a starving student living in a kind of an underground apartment, a little tiny basement apartment, to having all kinds of money. And it worked out very well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what got you started. Now, fast forward a few years, you actually ended up teaching entrepreneurship and business at J. Sargent Reynolds in Richmond, Virginia. When
yep.
it comes to your students, have you found that they are shocked when you share with them all of the principles that you share with them? Because a lot of times entrepreneurs, they're going into business very wide-eyed, full of optimism, and, you know, hey, I'm going to go and I'm going to conquer the world. And, you know, do they feel like you're sticking a pin in their bubble once you share with them that, okay, look, there are at least 102 principles that you found, and for them to watch out for and to be careful of and to, you know, help them to navigate? Do you find that many of them weren't anticipating that it would be as, what's the word I'm looking for, as in-depth venture as it is when you're talking about?
Well, I think that they don't realize how many there are, and but once they start into it, and we start going through what it takes to do a business plan and the many, many challenges that a business has, and they see that time and time and time again, that there is a principle that allows them to make an intelligent decision regardless of what the business is. Doesn't make any difference whether you're a hairstylist or you're a manufacturer or you're a retailer, whatever it is. That there are principles in common that allow you to make much, much more intelligent decisions. And one should always remember, when you're in business for yourself, it is your money that's at risk. and people going into it the first time, I think they understand that kind of in the abstract, but they don't really understand it up front and personally. And once they get started in it, they begin to, and they see how these little principles in detail things. You see, what people need who are in business is they need plans and principles that are actionable. And yes, the problem that most college courses in, on businesses have is they give these ivory tower solutions with these glowing, fuzzy ideas, but none of them are really actionable. Mm-hmm. So you should, they will say things like you have to have good advertising. Well, how do you put that into actually action? How do you mm-hmm. do that? Right. And what I have is, if you want to do a roadside sign, I tell them how to do it. You can have up to 7 words and a picture, not mm-hmm. 8, not 10, but 7. Mm-hmm. And if you drive down the highway, you'll see that this is true. And over and over again, my principles differ from others in that they're very specific and they are actionable. You can actually take an action. You can do it. And what is in most college textbooks and most business books is, when you read what they tell you, and you say, okay, that worked for this person, but these are my problems. How do I actually do it? How do I take an action? And you find out that what they're telling you, you really can't. And mm-hmm. that's what differs from mine. With mine, you can. Now, we're both talking about the same thing. I just get very specific so that you have something that you can do. And when you solve problems, you have to have a solution. And it can't be fuzzy. It has to be specific.
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph T. Geiger. We're talking about the book Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles. We're going through the book chapter by chapter, principle by principle. Last time we left off in chapter 4. We had 2 principles left in chapter 4, and then we'll move in to chapter 5, which is titled Buying a Business. But the 35th principle, which was back in chapter 4, is a great plan becomes a disaster when poorly executed. This is from the business plan chapter. Again, principle 35, a great plan becomes a disaster when poorly executed. Professor, a lot of people come up with some great ideas and some might have a great plan, but you got to have more than just a great plan. You got to know what to do with that plan, correct?
That's true. And what you need to do is the great plans that people come up, it can't be fuzzy. What you have to do is set up a timeline. So whatever your plan is, what are you going to do in the first week? And then you have to do it. And what are you going to do in the second week? So it can't be fuzzy at all. It has to be specific. And I was talking about that before, and it's true here. And where people fail is they come up with these generalized plans, and they don't break it down into a timeline. So what are you going to do in week number 1? What I used to do is every Friday, I had a business plan and a cash flow forecast that was a timeline was built into it. And the cash flow forecast was done monthly. And near the end of every month, I would take the coming month and divide it into weeks. So what am I going to do in the first, second, and third, fourth week of each month? And then come Friday, you took what you had set out to do in the coming week, and you break it down, who is going to do what? And then on Monday, you set about doing that. And on Wednesday, you reviewed how you were coming along. Are you on schedule or are you not on schedule? So let's say that one of the plans is you have $50,000 in receivables from people who have bought stuff from you, and you need to collect it. So that's what it was for the first of the month. So you break it down, is you assign somebody the job or a couple of people the job of collecting it. It cannot be the salesman. You don't want to turn the salesman into a bad guy. You need to have somebody in accounting to do it, and the person in accounting cannot be a tarantula. They have to be pleasant. And so, but who are they going to collect from? It is not sufficient to say that we're going to collect the $50,000. Specifically, who are you going to collect? Try to collect from on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And you set that up. You give it to one person. You say, okay, I want you to try to collect. It's $50,000, so let's try to collect $12,000 this coming week. You pick the people who owe $12,000, and you start calling them. Be nice about it, but be firm. And how are you going to collect it? And then you come up with a plan on what you're going to offer them in order to collect the funds to the specific people. And that's what I mean by a great plan turns into mush if it is poorly executed. Execution is where it's at, and execution predisposes very specific actions that you have to take on a timeline. And then you check on Wednesday and say, how are we doing? Have we collected our 12? If not, how much have we? Who have we called and who have we not called? And why have we not called them? So when you do that, things get done. When you don't do that, things don't get done.
All right. Well, again, that's the thing about plans in business. You got to work it. You got to work your plan. You got to plan your work, as you say, and you got to work your plan. And that's why this book is so important, because it's going to help everybody to have that mentor, for lack of a better term, that's going to be there every step of the way with you. I mean, if you've got the book, then you can always refer to it at any time. And so, again, we'll tell you how to get the book. But in the meantime, I want you to sit back and enjoy Professor Geiger, because if you love business, you're going to love the book and you're going to love this information that he's sharing. Principle 36 is, don't borrow money for longer than you must.
Well, that's again, if you borrow money for whatever it is, you need the lender will give you a way to pay it back. And if you are able to pay it back quicker, well, then for goodness sakes, do so. Because most business loans, you pay interest essentially based on how many days you have borrowed the money. So let's say we borrow $100,000 for a year, and you're given a rate of we'll make math really easy. So it's 12%, which means that every month you are essentially paying 1%. So if you happen to have a really good month, well then, perhaps instead of paying just a twelfth of it off, you know, 1 month's worth, pay as much as you can. Now, you need to make sure that when you do this, that you have structured the loan so that it can be paid off in advance. There are no penalties, but then if you need a back. And most lenders will do that, because if you tell them, hey, I'm going to pay it off sooner, they like that within reason. Now, they don't want to structure a big loan and then you pay it off a week later and they don't get any interest on it. But that's generally worked out, so it's pretty easy to handle. And usually there's a upfront cost for the loan, and then there's an interest that is paid. Essentially, you owe it per day. And there's a lot of loans, floor plans, and a lot of other loans that are done that way. It's fairly unusual for real estate loans, but most business loans are not real estate loans, and you can shrink it down as quickly as you can, and usually the lender will like that. Very, very occasionally they don't, but that is truly the exception and not the rule. So what a lot of people do is they borrow money, they pay it back right on the schedule, but if they can pay it back early, they don't. And they let money sit in their account. Well, today, if you have money sitting in your account, you'll be lucky to get 1% interest. And you might, if you're a good credit risk, you very likely will have a 6% loan. But if you leave the money set in your account, you're paying 6% interest. If you pay it off early, this is kind of found money. And it is really easy to increase your profits based on not having to pay interest on the loans you make, or on if you buy materials, inventory, normally those are sold on a 10%, 2%, 10, net 30. So you can pay it off within 10 days and very often pay no interest. If you wait for 30 days, well, then you pay a big glob of interest. And I've seen a number of companies that have doubled their profits at the end of the year just by paying their bills on time, which means within 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
And they doubled their profits. They didn't sell one more thing, one more dollar's worth of stuff. They just paid on time. Thus, they had no penalties, and they oftentimes had no interest.
You know, this is such valuable information because, again, there are no accidents when it comes to success. I mean, depending on how you determine success. But in business, you're not going to, just luck your way into success, especially if you're starting this from scratch. There's a way to do it. And I'm just very, very glad that we are having an opportunity to have this show that we can share this information because most small businesses fold within the first year because they just didn't do it the way it should have been done because for whatever reason, either they didn't know or they were misinformed, but you're getting an opportunity to listen to somebody who has over 50 years experience as an entrepreneur and is sharing his wisdom with us. So I encourage you to listen very, very closely. Okay, moving into Chapter 5. The title of the chapter is Buying a Business, and we'll start with principle number 37, which is a business is a profit machine, not a sewing machine. Professor?
Well, the reason I say that is because it is common for people to think that when you decide how much to pay for a business, it is done on the basis of how much does the business, the assets, what are the assets of the business? And so people decide what the assets of the business is. Well, that's fine if what you want to do is buy the business and then sell off the assets. So you need to know what the assets are. You need to know what the buildings are worth, the inventory is worth, and all of that. But the vast majority of businesses are not bought for that reason. They are bought to run. And so a business should be a profit machine. In other words, you don't really care what the assets are, you care whether or not the business can generate a profit. So let's say one of the big things going on now is on computers, and people have computer programs that generate a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you have a computer program that you have developed, and it took you a year to develop it, so you have your time invested, and you own a laptop computer. Well, what are the real hard assets? The hard assets are a used laptop computer. What's that worth? $500. but your computer program that's on it is generating $100,000 a year. Well, what is a business worth? $500 for the computer? Of course not. The business is worth how much money will this computer program that you've developed generate? And if it generates $100,000 a year, well, then it's probably worth up to $300,000 a year for your $500 computer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not the computer you're buying, it's the ability to generate a profit. So a business is a profit machine, not a sewing machine. You don't
mm-hmm.
care whether the equipment that you have, what it's worth being sold, unless you're going to sell off the assets and close the business. You want to
mm-hmm.
know whether it'll make a profit. And that's the only thing you should care about. And what you should care about is, can it make a profit? Has it made a profit in the past? And can you make it make a bigger profit? And if the answer is no, you really can't, whoever's done it is doing a pretty good job, well, then the business is probably worth a maximum of 3x earnings. Because if you can't make it do any better than the current owner, well, what happens when change happens? And it's going to happen, and maybe somebody will replant your super little computer program with a better one, in which case now you're not worth very much. But if you know how to make it better, well, then you can do it. I know a guy in Florida who bought a marina, and it was a marina that catered to commercial fishermen. So he was getting very little, he was getting some rent, and he was, the only thing he got was to haul out boats so that the owners of these commercial fishing boats could work on them. And he paid whatever it was, I don't remember what it was, for the business. And then immediately he began to change the business from catering to commercials to catering to yachtsmen. Well, a commercial guy might be able to work on the engine and paint the boat and change the prop, but some guy who owns a $100,000 yacht, he doesn't know one end of the thing from the other. He knows how to untie it from the dock and load his family aboard and go play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all he wants to do. He wants to make sure it runs good.
Right.
So what the guy did is in the first year, he tripled the income. He didn't care what the value of the docks were and the road into it and the buildings. It didn't make any difference to him. What he wanted to do is make it nice enough so that yachtsmen could come and hop aboard their boat and off they'd go. And he made it his life's work so that all those yachts, when the guy got there on the weekend, the darn thing ran. And he'd go start them on Wednesday and Thursday well ahead of time to make sure everything worked right so that the yachtsman was happy. And he charged them, of course, for this,
mm-hmm.
which the commercial guys, there's no way they'd pay him 5 cents for that. They could do that. And so he took this business, and in the first year he tripled the income, and by the second year it was up 5 or 6x from what he bought it for. So he had turned the business into an ever greater profit machine, and he didn't care a whit about the sewing machine part, what the docks were worth, other
right.
than to keep them nice for the yachtsmen.
Well, let me ask you a question, Professor, and this can lead us into the next principle. But when it comes to an individual that's selling a business, with the exception of the person saying, you know, hey, I've taken ill, you know, I can't run the business anymore, you know, because of my health. I mean, aside from a health issue that would prohibit the individual from running the business, which makes sense, of course, if he chooses to sell it, if he can't have anybody else run it for him, are there any other reasons that might raise a red flag? And then we're going to be moving into the next principle, which is trust but verify. But are there any red flags that when asking, well, why do you want to sell the business? Of course, that's a logical question. So with the exception of someone's health, I mean, because if they're saying, well, I want to sell it because I'm not turning a profit, you know, you might not want to buy it, you know. So with the exception of a health issue, you know, are there any red flags that potential buyers of businesses should be careful of?
Well, yes, that's the trust but verify part. That's why you do what they call due diligence, and you research it very carefully, why the person's selling it and whether what they're presenting about the business is true or not. But there's lots of reasons where people want to sell it. Some people, when you build a business, there are people who are good at starting and building a business but are not particularly good at managing the business. It takes two very, very different personalities to do those two things. And once a business gets started and gets going, they might kind of lose interest. Frankly, I'm that way. I love starting businesses. But once it gets to the stage that you're just grinding away and what you're doing is trying to reduce your costs by 0.5% here and 0.25% there and be a little more efficient here and a little more efficient there and you know, that sort of thing. I got to tell you, I lose interest right away. I like to build things. Mm-hmm. And the nature of businesses, they build pretty quickly and then they'll kind of plod along, and over a period of time, you build it and build it. The other thing is that remember when you're getting paid. Let's say that you start a business and you just eke out a bare living for a while, and then it's doing pretty good. So now you're getting paid $100,000 or you're paying yourself $250,000 a year, and taxes are taking damn near half of it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you sell the business, you pay capital gains, and I don't know what it is now, but it used to be 15%. So let's say that you had this rapidly growing business. You got to the point where you were taking $250,000 out, and that sounds really, really great. But, of course, the government was taking half of what you got, so you were actually clearing $125,000, $135,000, something like that. Still pretty good. But it's a little hard to save enough to retire on, and maybe you come up with another business idea. So you sell it. Well, if you're making that much, you're pulling that much out, and let's say the business is making that much again, so you're building equity in the business. And so between what you pay yourself and what the business generates is $500,000 a year. So you sell it for $1.5 million and you pay 15%. So let's see, that would be something like $225,000 in taxes. So you clear $1.25 million after taxes. That is what you would make in 10 years. So maybe you ought to sell the thing and take a portion of what you cleared, which is what you'd make in 10 years, and it's free and clear. You can invest it. You can live off of it, and that makes really good sense. So you've done your job of starting a business, and somebody else does their job of running it. And maybe they'll, because you're not really interested in that, they might be able to run it a little better.
Mm-hmm.
Like my friend who bought the commercial marina. The guy who started it just bought some old land and built this thing, and he did pretty well, but he didn't do anywhere near as well as the fellow who bought it and turned it into a yachtsman marina. So each of us has our place. We all have things that we're good at, and some of us are good at one thing but not particularly good at another. And I've got to admit myself that I am not a really, really good manager. I am a very good entrepreneur, but I'm not a very good manager. I just get bored with it.
Well, I know you've seen the show Shark Tank, and
yep.
So I'll ask this question. What about you have a business and somebody comes and says, you know, listen, I've been watching your business. I like your business. I'd like to learn more because I'd like to partner with you, okay? And we can split the profits, you know, either 50-50 or you know, what are your thoughts on partnering in terms of business? Is your position either run it or sell it? Or would you be a partner with somebody else in business?
No, I would not. I think partners, when you use the word partner, that is a particular kind of business form. There's C corporations, S corporations, partnerships, LLCs, all kinds of stuff. A general partnership is the world's worst deal. And if somebody came to me and said, let me show you how I turn dirt into gold, and I want you to be a general partner with him, I would say, no, I don't care what you do. I am not going to be a general partner with anybody because of the liability. In a general partnership, everybody is equally liable for everybody else's actions in full. So if I'm running this business and you join me, or you're running a business and I join you as a partner, and we just are doing pretty well, and we get a big contract and we put $2 million in the bank, so I write a check for the $2 million, send it to Rio, and I skip to Rio de Janeiro and live the good life, guess who's stuck with the debts? Juwanza is stuck with the debts. Juwanza's house is stuck with the debts. Juwanza's kids' college fund is stuck with the debts.
Right.
I'm in Rio. I'm having a grand time.
Mm-hmm.
So the answer to that is no. Somebody wants to buy my business, everything is for sale, with the exception of my wife and kids. Everything else is for sale. We're just haggling about the price.
Well, again, we touched on it as I had asked a question prior to it, but number 38 was trust and trust but verify. In business, it's not like, you know, back in the day you closed deals on a handshake and, you know, you talked about due diligence. That is so important, Professor, as you know. And I think it bears repeating even that you have to trust your partner. You know, or not partner, but whoever you're doing business with. I mean, you would definitely not knowingly, hopefully, do business with someone that was unscrupulous. But even so, you still have to verify. You still have to verify, correct? Verify, verify,
right.
Verify.
That's just doing the due diligence. And if you hit something that seems too good to be true, it probably is not true. It is too good to be true. There. So one of the things I use an example in the book to illustrate this of a guy that I met who wanted to buy a boat from me. He had a wholesale business and he sold it to some people, and his wholesale business appeared to have all of a sudden started to make a lot more money than it used to make, and he had engineered that. It was totally fake, but it was not criminal. He actually was doing it. However, it was not sustainable. And had the people said, now, wait a second, the nature of wholesale businesses are that they're as steady as you go, you get a little better every year, but having big growth spurts, it doesn't happen in that kind of business. That's just not the way it happens. It's not like all of a sudden we come up with an iPhone and we come from Apple did, where they all of a sudden started making billions, and it was all because of the iPhone. That makes sense. But wholesale businesses don't work that way. Mm-hmm. They are very much steady as you go. And had the people said, now, wait a second, why is this thing making all of this? In the last couple of years, he's making twice what he was 2 years before. What's going on here? And they started really, really digging. They might have found how he engineered it. And it was perfectly legal, but it was not sustainable. And remember that a business is a profit machine over time. And if it isn't going to keep doing it, well, then it's not a very good profit machine. So whenever you do your due diligence, you not only want to make sure that the I's are crossed and T's are dotted, you got to make sure that the whole thing makes sense. And if it doesn't make sense, then maybe you ought to back off. And in the example I use in the book, and it's a fascinating example, it's something that before I met this guy, it never would have occurred to me. But although it did, it didn't happen to me, it did happen to somebody else, and I learned from it. And when he wanted to buy a boat from me, I didn't want to sell him one. I elected not to sell him a boat because I was afraid what was really going to happen. Anybody who would be shady and do what he did, because he basically said or told me right out that what they're going to find out 6 months after they take over the business, that the profits are going to collapse. And they're going to have a hard time paying me, but I've already gotten 3 times real earnings, which is more than the business was worth. And when they're unable to make the last payments, I'll just take it over and rebuild it and do the whole thing again. And I said, I don't think I want to sell a guy a boat doing this because he'll find something wrong and I'll end up in court, and I have no interest in doing that.
Well, you know, Professor, that's wise. And that leads me to another question. I'm not going to say I'm sure you've seen this show, but there's a show that comes on. It's called Greed. And the show talks about people who have ultimately gotten caught and went to jail for just, you know, bad business practices. I mean, just outright lying and, you know, whether it's stock manipulation or whatever the case is. But there have been some very, very intelligent people who've gotten taken by people who've actually produced even earning statements, you know, just to prove to the person, the prospective victim, that, you know, whatever information that they felt like they wanted to show them to convince them that their company was a good company to either invest in or to, you know, somebody might come and say, I mean, just crazy stuff like, oh, if you give me, you know, what, $25,000, I can triple it in, you know, in a matter of months or something, and then show them these doctored documents that showed how they had actually done it for other people. So how is one, when we're talking about trust but verify, let's say somebody thinks that they're verifying, they're saying, okay, well, they schedule an appointment, go down to meet the guy, show me your books. And everything in the books is doctored, cooked. I mean, just cook the books, right? So how is a person to even, if they don't really know that what they're looking at isn't legit?
Well, you need to buy, if you're going to buy a business, you need to buy a business that you understand. Mm-hmm. In other words, if somebody wanted to sell me a business that ran hair salons, my answer is no, I'm not going to buy that. I don't know anything about that. And I don't want to be go into a learning curve on my dime because it's going to be an expensive dime. Again, if it's too damn good to be true, it's probably not true. Mm-hmm. And businesses very occasionally do that sort of thing. But when they do, the people who come up with it don't want to sell it. What you want to do when you sell a business is if it's growing 3 or 4 times a year, don't sell it then. Wait till it's growing at 10 or 20% a year and then sell it. But you make it grow fast. If it's doing that, then you do it yourself. You don't sell it. And when somebody would tell me something like that, I frankly wouldn't believe them. I don't care what the books are. I just don't mm-hmm. believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And that show is all based around that people want to believe stuff that their better angels know is not true. It can't be true.
Right.
And yet because they're greedy, they want to do it. Well, don't do that. I mean, that's an easy one.
Common sense. Sometimes
that's right.
Very easy. Well, Professor, let's move on to the next one now. We've got three left in this particular chapter. We've got, if you buy the stock, you buy all known and unknown liabilities. And number 40 is the guy with the gold makes the rules. 41 is try it before you buy it. So you can start with 39, okay? If you buy the stock, you buy the known and unknown liabilities.
Yeah, you never buy the stock. You never offer to buy the stock. You never sell the stock. You never talk about that. What you sell, you do is you buy the assets as a bulk sale. You do not buy the corporate structure because there is no possible way for you to know, even if you're dealing with the most honest person who ever walked, there's no way for you to know what is really in there. And there may be somebody who is just waiting for a chance to sue. In California, that is a sue-happy state. And anybody who buys a corporation, you never, ever buy the stock. There are lots and lots of famous ones who are very, very sophisticated people bought large companies, and they bought the stock, not the assets, and they ended up with horrific liability that went into the billions of dollars. And there was no way to know it was really there. Well, maybe there was, but they didn't find it. And in smaller business, the solution is the simplest thing in the world. You buy the assets, and it's called a bulk sale. Your attorney will help you structure that. It's a simple structure. It's done all the time. But do not buy the assets. Do not even talk about buying the assets. So if you're going to buy a company, you never, ever even talk about, I'm going to buy the stock in the company. That if they say that, you instantly change the subject and say, no, sir, I am not going to buy your stock. I will buy the assets. We'll do it as a bulk sale. But you do not ever buy the stock. So when the company changes hands, the old corporate structure dies at that moment. And you can be sued, but it's very difficult to sue. If you buy the stock, it's the simplest thing in the world to sue.
I hope everybody's listening, because you're hearing this information, and you're hearing it for a reason. Everybody that's listening to this show, it's no accident. You tuned in on purpose. Okay, so since you tuned in on purpose, then you're hearing this for a reason. Either it's a principle that you will see at some point, and you have now a reference point where you can actually come back and listen to the show again, and not just listen to the show. I encourage you how to get the book, and momentarily we'll be telling you just how to do that. Professor, the next one is The Guy with the Gold Makes the Rules. I like that title. That's very important for people to understand. Could you share on that?
Sure. Yeah, let's say that you want to buy. You have a company and you need investors, and you want to get some investors in. So you sell stock in the company, just like General Motors sells stock, or Ford sells stock, Apple Computer sells stock. You sell stock, and but you say one of the things I'll never ever do is I want to always own 51%. And small, unsophisticated people seem to think that that means they'll always control it. Well, they really won't always control it. The guy who can write the big checks control it. And so you get yourself in, they give you some money, and you go through the money, and now you need more. And let's say you sold 30% of the company, and so you go back to your investor, and you say, hey, we need another $100,000, and I understand I gave you, you bought 30% of the company when you gave me the $200,000. So with this other $100 that you want to pay, you'll own 45%. And they'll say, no, I don't think so. I think I've put in all I want to put in. So they sit back and wait until it is close time and the creditors are swirling around. They're after you. They're going to take your house and everything. And the big investor says, well, now, you know, I can prevent this from happening by I'll just co-sign a loan, but I want to own 90%. And then I want to have a buyout for your last 10% on my terms. So the guy with the gold is the one who's going to make the rules. Very often, industries get together, or companies get together, and they form a group of, let's say, three companies. And there's two great big ones and you. And you have the brains, and they have the money to put into it, and they have some of the other assets that need to go into it. And then the company's doing really, really well. And the other two come to you and say, well, you know, our mutual company here is really doing well. We all own 33%. We're just happy as clams. But what we really need to do is double this thing. So we each need to come up with another $2 million. And coming up with $2 million for them is simple. Coming up for $2 million for you, it's just ain't no way. And
right.
So they say, well, you know, we all vote here, and 66% says we each need to come up with $2 million, and they put in their two, and each of them, and you can't. And say, so they say, well, gee, you need to sell your 33% to us for 50 cents on the dollar because, I mean, you know, we're coming up with this money and you're not you're not carrying your weight.
Right.
So you lose out. The guy with the gold makes the rules.
Professor, we've got another principle that would be the last one for this chapter, but I want to take some time and ask about what's going on. I know you were mentioning in the last show that you started teaching entrepreneurship in schools, and I don't know how much time it would take to actually do both, because I really want to hear about it. I don't know if you have time to go over a little bit. So which would you prefer? We can hold this one until next week if you wanted to share a bit, and I want to tell everybody how to get your book. So would you like to share on what's, because we can hold this one, this last one, until next week. It's try it before you buy it, and I don't know if in the little bit of time that we have left whether it would be time enough for you to do that principle justice.
Well, not really. Let me tell you, I'm going to do an entrepreneurship class at John Tyler Community College this fall. It starts August the 22nd at John Tyler College. And it's at their main campus, it's the one that's just right off 95, for those of you who are listening who are in this area. And it's a three-hour-a-night class for 16 nights. It's on, the first one is, it's on a Monday from 6:30 until 9:15 every night for essentially 16 nights. And for anybody who has any interest in being an entrepreneur, it's not an easy class. I got to tell you, I divide the students into groups of 3 to 5, and they write a 50 to 60 page business plan. That's the final test. We go through a book. A very, very good textbook. It's the first and only textbook on business I ever found that was written by people who have actually done it. Most of the books that college texts are written by PhDs who have read what other people have done, but they've never, ever started a business. They've never run a business. Some of them have never even worked in a business. They've only been in academia. And but this is taught by somebody who's actually done it, me. I go through most of the principles in my book, and then we cover another little book some. So it's a bit of a rigorous class, But for those who have an interest in starting a business, when you get through, you'll know how to do it, and you won't make foolish errors. Class actually already has 5 students in it, which, I mean, is astonishing, because it's not like it starts in a month. It doesn't start until in August. So, but it already has 5. So we'll, I'm sure it'll fill up pretty well. And I think they have a limit of 30 students in it. And I'm also doing one other thing. I started a seminar, a group of seminars, to teach high schoolers and junior, seniors in high school, freshman, sophomore, college, how to find a career for life. And it's a systematic system to choose a career. One of the problems that college people have is there have been lots of studies done on it, and what they always end up saying is 6 months to a year after graduation, that over half of all college students are working at jobs that require no higher education of any kind. In other words, they're flipping hamburgers or they're totally unemployed. And the primary reason is they pick majors that do not lead to jobs. And unfortunately, colleges and high schools are not telling young people, young adults, which ones are good and which ones are bad. The high schools and colleges don't really appreciate what I'm doing all that much, because I do tell them. And I tell you that, for example, what are the 10 best and what are the 10 worst? And number one on the 10 worst is psychology. And yet 15% or more of most liberal arts schools, the students graduate with a 4-year degree in psychology, which is fine if that's your passion, so long as you understand that you're going to have a hard time finding a job as a psychologist unless you have a PhD. And if you do have a PhD, you should be able to find a job that will pay about a third of what a bachelor's degree in petroleum engineering pays. So I go through what are the good jobs, what are the bad, what are the good cities to go to that are growing the best, what are the growing jobs, and what are the most secure jobs, what are the industries, how to do it if you don't have a lot of money, what can you do if you have to have income right now. You just don't have the luxury of somebody paying for 4 years. You got to go now. Well, there's a way to do it. And 10 years from now, you could be in an industry absolutely secure where you can expect to be making over $100,000 a year. But you got to have a goal, and you have to know how to do it. And I tell them how. I'm doing a book. I'm turning this seminar into a book, which I should have finished in a month and a half. So we'll have seminars in the Richmond area. Give me a call. You'll find them as they show up at theroadtothetop.com. And so that's what I'm doing there.
And they can also get this book at theroadtothetop.com, The Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles. They can actually get that by contacting you at theroadtothetop.com, correct?
Yep, you can get it there. You can get it at Amazon. The only difference is when I send them out, I sign them.
And
so Amazon and I charge exactly the same thing for the book. They go out just as quickly either way. And the only difference, like I say, is that I sign the books. But you can get it either place.
And they can get a cash flow forecast too as well, correct?
That's right. On my website, if you want to know what a real cash flow forecast looks like, what the template looks like, I've got it. It's only $15, but if you fill it out and it's a fill in the blanks type thing, that it's tried and true, it really works, and it lets you know how much money you're going to need for your new business, and equally important, when you need it.
everybody. This has been a very, very powerful show with Professor Joseph T. Geig. I encourage everybody to go get the book, TheRoadToTheTop.com, Entrepreneurial Success. It'd make an awesome gift for anybody out there who you know is an entrepreneur or thinking about becoming an entrepreneur, even a high school senior. You know, it's not too early to have people starting to think about what they want to do when they graduate. And it's not always that people have to go the same path. You know, everybody wasn't meant for college. College just wasn't meant for everybody. And there are countless of success stories of people who actually thought college was, dropped out, and ended up becoming some of the richest people in the world. You know, one of them the richest in the world. So I just want to encourage everybody, if you're in the Richmond area, find out more about the classes. Go to The Road to the Top and contact Professor Geiger. Also, get this book because, again, we're going through it principle by principle, chapter by chapter, and you don't have to wait until next month before you get more information on this. You can actually read up and read ahead. And even, you know, when we come back, then you can actually get the context within which Professor is actually putting these principles in a much broader sense. He gives examples in the book. I mean, it's just an awesome book. I've read it like 3 or 4 times, and so I encourage you to do the same because you're going to need it. If you're going into business, you're going to need it. And these are life principles as well. I want to reiterate that. These are life principles as well. I've actually come across certain situations in life where I actually referred back to a principle that was in this book, in the business book. I can't think of one right off the top of my head, but I know that I've used this book in other situations outside of business, and I know that you will too. Professor Geiger, I want to thank you again for being my special guest today. Always a pleasure talking to you. Any parting words for our listeners before you go today?
Well, the only thing I can tell them is whether they understand it today or not, if you are making money, according to the IRS, a third of you to 40% of you will be self-employed at some time during your career. And that's been a historic fact. As a matter of fact, it is that percentage is going up every year. So even though if you think, well, I'm never going to start a business, a third of you to 40% of you will, whether you believe it or not. And with the internet as it is, it makes it a lot easier, but you can also lose money because half of them all die in the first year because of very poor planning. It's a shame. Could be avoided. That's the facts.
And that's why I reiterate, it's important that you get this book. If you're serious, then you'll get this book. Just think about it. If you've ever gone out and gotten a book on success principles and there were only 10 or 5 or something like that, and here I'm telling you that there's a book with where there's 102, over 100 business principles, then those 5 that you got, okay, well, there's 95 more, over 95, 97 more that you didn't get. So I encourage you to go out and get this book. You won't regret it. It's worth the price. What is it, $18, $19, Professor?
Yes, sir. Yeah, it's $18 plus shipping, and I charge the same as Amazon does. So we don't make any money shipping them, I can tell you that for sure. But that's what it costs. And the cash flow forecast, there is no shipping cost. We send that out by the internet.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody, each principle is worth more than the cost of the book. Okay, so you know, you're getting a good deal on this. So I want to again thank you, Professor Geiger. It's always a pleasure. We look forward to you coming back on next month. And I want to encourage everybody again, if you know of an entrepreneur, or if you are one yourself, you owe it to yourself, truly, to get this book. You won't regret it. I guarantee you, if you get the book, you'll be referring it yourself. So, Professor, thank you so much. I'll be in touch. Thanks again. Great, great show.
Bye for now.
Everybody, that was Professor Geiger, again, author of the fabulous book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, 102 Business Principles. You didn't know there was 102? At least 102, okay? So by all means, make sure that you get the book. You won't regret it. If you're serious, it can save you a lot of money, and it can save you a lot of time, and it can save you a lot of headaches. So until the next time, my name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. This has been our wealth segment. And again, Professor Geiger comes on once a month, but get the book. That way you don't have to wait until next month to enjoy reading the principles. So thank you so much for your time. I certainly appreciate you. To all of the entrepreneurs, I wish you much, much success. Until the next time.